All righty, we're starting in again with session 15, page 122 in your notebook. Let's do a little bit of a review. Again, we're at the end of Exile, section 3, the third major section of your class here. Last week, we took a look at His Eminence, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin Effendi al-Husseini, one of the most vigorous opponents of Zionism and the State of Israel. We'll learn a little bit more about him as we go through here. He encouraged the Arab revolt of 1937. As the revolt of 1937 wore on, the Yishuv realized that all the Yishuv needed to be protected, not just in a kibbutz over here, a moshav over there, and the job of protecting the kibbutz, protecting the Yishuv, fell to General Yitzhak Sadeh. Remember, he had pioneered the idea of an active defense. The best defense is an offense, right? So that was expanded when the British were running out of manpower to control this revolt, and they allowed the Haganah to come out of its illegal status and become the Haganah soldiers to become members of the British units as gafirs, and Captain Ord Wingate was assigned to be their commander. And with his creative and audacious style, he expanded the idea of active defense and really kept the Arab marauders off base. He was a born-again Christian who supported Zionism and who wanted to lead Israel's armies against her enemies, but didn't get his chance. Remember, he died in 1944 in Burma in a plane crash fighting in World War II. But he made a very significant impact on the early state of Israel. In response to the Arab revolt, the Woodhead Commission was sent to Israel to look into the reasons behind the revolt. And they were housed in the Palace Hotel, which had been constructed by Husseini, the Mufti. And I mentioned last week that it has been refurbished now. This is what you'll find if you go there today. You'll find the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. It's the same building as the Palace Hotel, only it's now back in operation. So this is the hotel that the British were housed in, and it's pretty posh these days, isn't it? The Zionists hung microphones in the chandeliers and listened in on the British deliberations, and they learned that the British were thinking of splitting up the Palestine into an Arab and Jewish state. So remember, the Peel Partition Plan of 1937 reduced the Jewish state from everything west of the Jordan River to simply a Jewish state along the coast and the Galilee. Everything else would be an Arab state. But then the Woodhead Commission went even further, and they were suggesting that they would even take the Galilee away from the Zionists so that the Jewish state would be reduced to simply a small strip of land along the coast. And again, what we're seeing here is Satan doing his best to squeeze the Jewish state out of existence. Put his hands around the throat of the Jewish state and choke it off. Then we talked a little bit about Kristallnacht in Germany, where Jewish businesses were ravaged. And here's some pictures of the damage. Synagogues were burned, Jewish people were arrested, and many, many began to immigrate to Israel, where they strengthened the urban sector of the new state. Then we finished up last week by looking at Program 9 of Against All Odds, The People, The Book, Come Home, a little bit about immigration. So that brings us to where we are tonight, and we're on page 122, the beginning of World War II. Everybody there then? The 100th year of Zionism. The 100th year of Zionism was marked by the beginning of World War II, 1839 to 1939. And World War II, just like World War I, will have a very significant impact on the modern state of Israel. So let's pick it up at the London Roundtable Conference. Now, the London Roundtable Conference opened February 7th, 1939 at St. James Palace in London. It's also called the St. James Conference. You may see it under both names. And here is St. James Palace as it looks today, still a very operating building in London. This is where it occurred. The Arabs refused to sit in the same room with the Jews. So arrangements were made for the two delegations to enter the palace by separate entrances. My response to that, how petty. How petty and prideful. But that's the Middle East. What devolved, therefore, was essentially two parallel conferences, and you can see that from the photographs. Here is one photograph in the Palace Hotel. Yes, and I want you to note, because the next picture is not going to be nearly as good as this one, I want you to note the camera angle, the picture on the left wall, the picture probably of the Queen at the very end of the room, and in the foreground, you have this arc of seats with the Zionist delegation. Okay, everybody's sitting there, right? So that's the Zionist delegation. Now, the next picture, notice the same exact camera angle. You've got the pictures along the wall, the Queen at the back. But who is sitting in the seats in the foreground? This is the Arab delegation. So the Zionist delegation would come in, they'd talk with them, and then they'd leave, and the Arab delegation would come in. You would think the Arabs would be upset after sitting in a seat that had been warmed by Jews, you know. But that's what happened because of the pride and the pettiness of the Arab point of view. Two separate conferences devolved. That's what happened. Now, in a private meeting with the Zionists, Colonial Secretary MacDonald asserted frankly that Britain's lifeline in the Middle East largely depended upon sympathetic understanding of the Arab world. What was the lifeline? Oil and the Suez Canal. Remember that. Oil and the Suez Canal. That was their worry. With war imminent, His Majesty's government was left with no choice but to ensure that the Arab governments were not tempted to accept support from hostile powers. And he's referring to the Axis powers there, Italy and Germany. If it came to a choice between Arab and Jewish support, MacDonald explained that Jewish help, however valuable, represented no compensation to Britain for the loss of Arab and Muslim goodwill. The key Arab demand remained unchanged. It was the termination of the mandate, termination of the award of independence to Palestine, and the formation of an Arab-dominated state. Notice the hypocrisy here. They wanted termination of the very mandate that provided for their national countries, for Arab nationalism. The very mandate that provided for Arab nationalism and Jewish nationalism, they wanted terminated. But they didn't want their side of it terminated. They just wanted the Jewish side of it terminated. If they were being objective about it, they would say, take away our countries as well. Take away the Jewish country, take away our countries. But oh no, no, no. Just the end, we just want the end of the Jewish state. Again, blatant hypocrisy. All right, the British, however, agreed to this demand in principle. MacDonald revealed the contours of the government's emerging Palestine formula March 15th. He proposed that Jewish immigration be limited to 75,000 during the next 5 years, with further immigration to depend on Arab consent. Think they would consent to that? The deck is stacked. Land sales would be curtailed. Well, interestingly enough, both sides rejected MacDonald's formula. The Arabs, because it allowed too much. The Zionists, because it allowed too little. Now, as it developed, the British made the decision to appease the Arabs at the very moment when the rebellion in Palestine was sputtering out. In August of 1939, the disturbances finally ended after 3 years of fighting. By then, the toll had reached 6,768 casualties, 2,394 were Jewish, 610 were British, and 3,764 were Arabs. As usual, the Arabs got the worst end of the deal when they created their own rebellion. All right, MacDonald White Paper. May 17th, London issued the MacDonald White Paper. His Majesty's government had decided to establish a quota of 10,000 Jewish immigrants for each of the next 5 years, plus another 25,000 refugees. So exactly what MacDonald wanted, 75,000 Jews. After a period of 5 years and 75,000 immigrants, no further Jewish immigration would be permitted without Arab permission. Sale of land to Jews was prohibited immediately. So this declaration of British policy was a foreclosure on any subsequent growth for the Jewish national home. More than that, worse than that, you guys, it sealed off Palestine as a haven for all but an insignificant fraction of Jewish refugees. And this, at the very moment when European Jewry faced a mortal threat to its continued physical survival. The Holocaust is ramping up. It's going on. Well, guess what? The Arab Higher Committee chose for tactical reasons to denounce the white paper. Too much immigration. And the Zionists were just as clear-cut. It's too little. They both rejected it. On May 18th, the day after the white paper was issued, the Jews of Palestine conducted demonstrations throughout the country, furiously denouncing the white paper in synagogues and public meetings. And here's some photographs of those occurrences. This is Jerusalem, 1939. Here we have a crowd of Jewish people stopped by the British. You can see the British on the left there. Stopped from marching any further but protesting the white paper. So there's an example in Jerusalem. Here's an example in Tel Aviv. You can see the demonstrators at the upper right corner and the British officials, police and military, barring the street saying you're not going to come any further. Now these pictures make it seem like everything was quiet, but that wasn't the case. Isolated riots broke out. One policeman was killed. The revisionist paramilitary organization, the Irgun Zvi Le'umi, Etzel bombed a number of government buildings in Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv, and they sabotaged rail lines. So things got a little hairy for a while. In Britain itself, the white paper met with serious criticism on all sides. No criticism was harsher than Churchill's. Churchill, you know, allowed the mandate to be split in two between Transjordan and Palestine, but he was incensed that it would go any further. Here's what he said. This pledge of a home of refugees, of an asylum, was not made to the Jews of Palestine, but to the Jews outside Palestine, to that vast, unhappy mass of scattered, persecuted, wandering Jews whose intense, unchanging, unconquerable desire has been for a national home. That is the pledge which was given, and that is the pledge which we are now asked to break. A pretty straightforward language, page 124. When the Palestine issue reached a vote in the House of Commons at the end of the month, the cabinet won a slim majority. A bare 268 votes were cast in approval out of a total of 413. 179 voted against the white paper with an unprecedented 110 abstentions. So if the guys that stood on the fence, the abstentions, if they had voted against the white paper, it would have been 289 against, 268 for. It would have not passed. But those who were on the fence really were ended up supporting the white paper. You know, that's what happens when you abstain. Whatever passes, you've supported it in your abstention. So when something comes up, guys, you know, if you really feel strongly about it, vote for it or vote against it. The Chamberlain government's stringently anti-Zionist interpretation of the mandate required the approval of not only Parliament but also the League Permanent Mandates Commission. And the members of the commission did not accept the argument. In their report to the League Council, they declared that the policy set out in the white paper was not, underline that, was not in accordance with the interpretation which, in agreement with the mandatory power and the council, the commission had placed upon the Palestine mandate. So the Zionists were vindicated. But the vindication by the world body was little consolation. Now, at this time, Zionist resistance began to take shape. The Jewish Agency publicly sanctioned and privately organized clandestine immigration. The influx of illegal refugees became unusually heavy after the spring of 1939. Agricultural settlements continued to go up under cover of darkness. Stockade and Watchtower settlements, remember them? The agency ordered a secret Haganah registration of all men and women between the ages of 18 and 35. Now, for Britain, the White Paper of 1939 appeared to pay off. A major part of the oil resources of the Commonwealth were in the Arab world. The MacDonald White Paper, by and large, succeeded in keeping the Arab world quiet, and this was its rationale. Keep the Arabs on our side. That was the idea. However, for the Jews, for the Zionists, the White Paper of 1939 was a likely death warrant for their people in Europe, and conceivably for the very hopes of Palestine. All right, United Jewish Appeal. Fundraising was no means an experimental venture for the American Jewish community in 1939. Jewish federations had been operating in American cities for decades, although earlier in the century they were oriented primarily to local and sometimes to a few national Jewish communal needs. Then during World War I and the post-war years, welfare funds were devoted increasingly to such overseas needs as a National Refugee Service, the Joint Distribution Committee, and finally the United Palestine Appeal. Later too, as the Nazi horror began to unfold in the 1930s, the decision was made to integrate the campaigns for these overseas philanthropies into a single fundraising organization to be known henceforth as the United Jewish Appeal. So here's the way it started. This is a poster promoting the United Palestine Appeal, now known as the United Jewish Appeal. Help them build the Jewish future. Support the United Palestine Appeal. So there's where it started. Henry Montour was appointed the first executive director of the newly founded United Jewish Appeal in 1939. However, the United Jewish Appeal became more than just a fundraising organization. Over the years, the UJA has become an important educational factor in American Jewish affairs. Throughout its widening program of institutes, lectures, and workshops, the UJA brought before the Jewish public information regarding Jewish history and contemporary Jewish life. And, of course, federations are still operating strongly. This is the website of the Jewish Federation of Greater Los Angeles, just up the road a ways. And again, notice the educational effort. Community engagement, learn, build, lead. So the UJA builds Jewish identity in the diaspora and encourages, of course, Aliyah. So it's vital in the diaspora because there's we're integrating into the culture. What do you call that? Assimilation. There you go. Yes, so much assimilation going on. All right, top of page 125. Lohamei Herut Yisrael Lechi founded. Now, beyond the control of the Jewish agency itself, there emerged a number of activist splinter groups, limited in number, but fanatical in purpose, that were unwilling any longer to accept Zionist discipline at a time when Jews were being exterminated in Europe and the British were barring the doors of Palestine to survivors. The technique adopted by these militants was violence. The most ungovernable faction in the emergent underground movement was the Fighters for the Freedom of Israel, simply known as Lehi for its Hebrew initials. And here is their logo, their flag, Lehi. It consisted of only about 300 members. It wasn't a big organization. And so it was one of a handful of Jewish paramilitary organizations that sprang up during or immediately following the Arab insurrection of 1936 to 1939. Now, its founder was Avraham Stern, and you have this portrait of Avraham Stern on page 125. This is the founder of the Lehi. And so this guerrilla group was commonly known as the Stern Gang, after Avraham here, the Stern Gang. Now, Avraham Stern was a Polish-born Jew in his early 30s. He was a teacher. He was a dabbler in poetry. You'd hardly think he'd become a terrorist. He had briefly studied classics at the University of Florence. He had been decisively influenced there by what he saw of fascist tactics and Mussolini's intense fear of England. He was soon convinced, here's the idea, here's what happened. He was soon convinced that Britain's presence in the Middle East was harmful to the future development of the Jewish national home. He came to the conclusion that all emphasis should be placed on anti-British rebellion. Now, no other Jewish underground group had been willing to go that far, not even Etzel. But after the outbreak of World War II, Stern moved even further to the right. Desperate for money, Stern and Lehi were soon reduced to occasional bank robberies, you know, robbing their own people.
Robin Hood.
In January of 1942, a Sternist bomb attempt meant for a British intelligence officer instead killed two Jewish police officers. A few weeks later, Stern was shot dead by the police. Far from ending Lehi's militancy, these events seemed to impel its remaining members to acts of even greater desperation. Their hatred of the British transcended reason or control. Now, on page 126, I've summarized Zionism in a chart from 1839 to 1939. So if you want to just see the basic outline of all that's going on, you can read through that chart. So let's move instead to 1941. Let's jump ahead to 1941 on page 127. The Palmach organized. As World War II progressed, the British suffered stunning defeats in North Africa at the hands of the German tank commander Erwin Rommel. Throughout the long and painful ordeal of retreat, Britain derived small encouragement from its Arab treaty partners, its Arab allies. King Farouk of Egypt communicated admiration and support for Hitler. Iraq, intensely anti-British. No courtship of the Axis was more avid, however, than the one carried out by the Mufti of Jerusalem. Up on the screen, there is the most famous picture of the Mufti.
Wow.
Went to Berlin, sat down with Hitler himself, and discussed how they would get rid of the Jews in the Middle East and Hitler would take care of them in Europe. So there he is with the Führer. And when he was in Germany, he inspected the troops. There he's inspecting German troops, and he hobnobbed with some of the soldiers. So he was fervently pro-Nazi.
But really, wasn't Hitler, though, against any Middle Eastern?
Well, don't kid yourself. Whoever allied with Hitler would soon find themselves conquered by Hitler. Sure. Though sorely tried, the British were not entirely without local support in the Middle East. The Jews remained loyal because we faced a common enemy. The Jewish agency mobilized the Yishuv's resources for wartime agricultural and industrial purposes. In the first month of the war, the Va'ad Le'umi, the National Council, remember them, talked about them long ago. The National Council announced the registration of volunteers for national service. 136,000 men and women enrolled. Their motivation was not simply an understandable desire for battle against the Nazis, but the expectation that an armed and active Jewish force would obligate Britain to reconsider the Zionist case. Remember, they had just squashed the Zionist case with the latest white paper. Additionally, military skills acquired during the war could be put to good use later. We have some seichel going on here, some sharp thinking going on here. Seichel, common sense. Okay? It was the Jewish agency's hope to organize these troops as a separate force under their own flag, something akin to the Zionist Mule Corps of World War I. Remember those guys? Okay. From the outset, the idea was opposed by British military and civilian officials in the Middle East. General Sir Evelyn Barker, the British commander of Palestine, warned London that the establishment of a Jewish fighting unit in the region, in the Middle East, would provoke a renewed Arab uprising. And he was probably 100% right. We have a big change in the spring of 1940. Winston Churchill assumes the prime ministry. Churchill was intrigued by the idea of arming Palestine Jewry, if only to release British troops in the Holy Land for other fronts. The decision was postponed by Churchill, and by the time anything came of a Jewish army concept, the war in the Middle East was over. However, when the military situation turned against Britain, senior Haganah officers were invited to collaborate with the British in preparing lists of bridges and tunnels that were vulnerable to sabotage in Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, and Iran. And other joint efforts followed. In early spring of 1941, Rommel's Panzer Army launched its operations in the Western Desert, and Nazi infiltration of Syria became more overt. The Haganah cooperation was urgently needed. The need soon became evident for a permanently mobilized Jewish task force. Such a unit, accordingly, was established by the Haganah in May of 1941 and classified as the Palmach, the Plugat Machatz, the strike companies. And here is the Palmach logo, the strike companies. First permanently mobilized task force. One of its purposes was the defense of the Yishuv against Arab bands that inevitably would harass the Jewish towns and settlements the moment the British retreated from Palestine. More importantly, if when Axis armies entered the country, the Palmach would be employed to attack the enemy whenever possible, disrupt his communications, sabotage his transport and airfields. The commander of the new elite force was, not surprisingly, good old Yitzhak Saadeh. Remember him? He had a big impact on the IDF, the formation of the IDF, General Yitzhak Saadeh. As in the 1930s, the veteran night fighter immediately set about recruiting the Haganah's ablest young men, mainly from the kibbutzim. Page 128. On the eve of the Allied invasion of Syria, June 8, 1941, Palmach volunteers were needed for a final reconnaissance of Vichy positions. Now, you may not be familiar with that term Vichy. That's a reference to the French government that collaborated with the Nazis. Okay, the French were conquered by the Nazis. The Vichy government collaborated. Now, Saadeh chose two companies for the task. The officers were the commander's favorites, Moshe Dayan and Yigdal Alon. Now, up on the screen, we see a warm picture of these three. There's Moshe Dayan on the left, in the middle, General Yitzhak Saadeh, and on the right, Yigdal Alon. That's his two favorite officers. And, of course, these two young officers would have a great impact on Israel's military future as well. So there's their early career with the Palmach. Now the troops were divided into 12 squads. Two of these units guided the advancing Australians. Others cut wires and ambushed Vichy patrols guarding bridges over the Litani River. They blew up culverts. They sabotaged roads. In the attack on Iskandern, Moshe Dayan showed exceptional bravery, capturing 12 Vichy troops. Later, in an exchange of fire, he lost an eye. And so Moshe Dayan is known, you know, more commonly as the one-eyed Israeli soldier, right? Well, he was scanning the enemy lines with a binocular, and a bullet hit the left lens of the binocular. Well, it saved his life, but it pushed all that metal and glass into his eye. And there was so much damage to the eye socket that they couldn't put a glass eye in there. And so he had to wear the eye patch for the rest of his life. And if you look at the picture closely, you can see the damage to his bridge, and you can see get an idea of the amount of damage there. So from then on, Moshe Dayan is the famous one-eyed Israeli general. The Litani River is up in what we call up north in Lebanon today. All right. In July of 1942, Rommel's forces were hurled back at Al Alamein, that's near Egypt, and 4 months later, driven out of Libya altogether by the reorganized 8th Army under the command of Lieutenant General Bernard Montgomery. Once the danger to Palestine ebbed in the autumn of 1942, the British closed the various Palmach training bases. The British, in turn, relegated the Haganah to its former illegal status. Refusing dissolution, however, the Jewish Defense Force simply became underground once again. Indeed, its members swelled to 21,000 men and women. The Palmach also remained intact in various scattered kibbutzim, training secretly, organizing a clandestine naval program, developing a rudimentary air arm under the facade of a tiny aviation club. I believe they started with a Piper Cub. By then, having worked closely with the British, the Haganah and the Palmach leadership understood better the ways in which a European regular army functioned and what its strengths and limitations were. So guess what? God is forming the foundation now of the IDF. It's going to be needed. The Lord knows it's going to be needed. And so he's putting the pieces together, even now. All righty. I've kept you a couple of minutes into your break. We'll pick it up in 1942 with the massacres in occupied Russia. So go ahead and take your break and listen for the shofar. All righty, let's pick it up at 1942. We advanced ahead a few years. 1942, massacres in occupied Russia. The death camps of Auschwitz, Majdanek, and Treblinka begin to function at full capacity. So things are going pretty bad for the Jewish people in Eastern Europe. Now, in regard to the death camps and the British government, I ran across a revelation in 1995. Some new insight into all that was going on came out in 1995, and I'd like to share it with you. This came from the World Jewish Congress. That's a little magazine. Dateline World Jewry, June 1995, on page 1. Here was the article, the important part of the article. The British Broadcasting Corporation may have underreported the Holocaust because of fear of upsetting the Arab world, according to a recently aired program on the BBC. So isn't this totally consistent?
Yes.
Totally consistent with what we've been seeing. Keep the Arabs happy. You know, now, why did they do this? Frank Roberts, a wartime Foreign Office official, reveals in an interview that we wanted to keep the Middle East quiet. We had to be careful. We didn't give the Arabs the impression that we'd suddenly turned into a pro-Jewish, pro-Zionist organization. So we'll just keep the lid on the Holocaust. We'll just keep the lid on the Holocaust. We won't let anyone know about it. Totally consistent with British attitudes at the moment. Yes. Well, they were desperate, that's true. They were in the middle of a war, but they made some decisions that cost 6 million Jewish lives.
Yeah.
You know, so.
They took in a lot of children.
Yeah, they took in a certain amount of homeless orphan children, that's true.
The oil resources, that could have been very critical to the war effort.
Well, right, sure. I don't dispute that they were in a hard spot, but they also allowed the Nazis to go unimpeded with the death camps. So, I don't know. We'll leave it up to the Lord to make a decision on that.
But America didn't do anything either.
Well, nobody did anything. No, nobody did anything. All righty. Now, another very sad incident during this time is the Struma. The Struma. In 1942, an incident occurred which became, for the Yishuv, the very symbol of Britain's unrelenting wartime policy toward the refugees. December 16, 1941, the SS Struma entered the harbor of Istanbul and dropped anchor. She was an unseaworthy vessel of 180 tons. And you have a picture of the Struma there. Steam and sail-powered. Old ship. Not all that seaworthy anymore. Okay, she'd seen her better days. Several weeks before, it had departed the Romanian port of Constanta and limped along the Black Sea coast with Palestine as its goal. Now, with its engine malfunctioning and its hull leaking badly, the Struma was forced to anchor for repairs. The ship was packed with 769 refugees for a voyage across the high seas. Unable to proceed further, the Jews implored the Turkish government for sanctuary. The appeal was turned down. Page 129. From Romania. They were escaping from Romania. Barred from going forward, unwilling to return, the Struma passengers remained in Istanbul harbor for 2 months, suffering from hunger, overcrowding, and mounting panic. The Jewish agency implored the British to allow the refugees entrance into Palestine, if only for transshipment to another destination outside of Palestine, Mauritius. You know where Mauritius is? Anyone heard of that place? You know where it is?
Mauritius.
Is that a better? All right. Well, here's where it is, you guys. There's the Indian Ocean, Madagascar, Africa. See that little tiny isolated island there? There it is. Why that was picked, I don't know. But maybe because nobody wanted to go there, I don't know. Anyway, that's what the Jewish agency said. Send them to this little tiny isolated island. The British refused. Eventually, on February 24th, 1942, the Turks ordered the Struma towed out of the harbor. 5 miles beyond the coastline, the ship took on water and sank with the loss of 428 men, 269 women, and 70 children. There was one survivor. One person survived. Later, recent reports indicate it was torpedoed by a Russian submarine. That it just didn't take on water.
A ship will take on a lot of water with a torpedo.
Yes, yeah. Here's what happened. Here's basically, I'll give you a picture overview. There's the Black Sea to the north and Palestine there to the south. We're going to zero in on the Bosphorus, which is that tiny little passageway between the Black Sea and the Sea of Marmara. So let's zero in closer. There's Constanta, Romania. That's where the refugees were fleeing from. And here is the Bosphorus, or Bosporus, depending on whether you use Greek or Turkish spelling. And now let's take a little look at the pathway. They hugged the shoreline because they were not very seaworthy. They came down to the Bosphorus. Now here is a satellite view of that little passageway between the Sea of Marmara and the Black Sea. Istanbul, of course, is that huge city to the south. And here, of course, is a picture. It's a little bit hazy of Istanbul and the Bosphorus, but you're looking south. You're looking south, and the city is there in the middle of the picture. So this is where this event occurred. So here's what happened. Again, here's the Struma. She comes down the coast and turns into the Bosphorus and has to anchor here in Istanbul harbor. She can't get repairs, so she's quarantined there for 2 months. Finally, after frantic requests to take care of the people on board, the Turks have her towed back out of the Bosphorus,
oh, really?
Back into the Black Sea, 5 miles out. There's
wow.
Where she is torpedoed.
Oh,
one survivor. Pretty sad story. Pretty disgusting story. The horrified reaction of Palestine Jewry was at least partially echoed in other Allied countries. Even in Britain, the tragedy was angrily debated in the House of Commons. 1944, Etzel and Lehi strike at the British. After 1944, the Lehi, under its new leaders, Nathan Friedman Yellen and Dr. Israel Scheib, concluded that violence was the one method capable of driving the British from Palestine. So here are the new leaders of Lehi, Israel Scheib, also known as Israel Eldad. Of course, that's a picture of him in his later years. And this is a picture of Nathan Friedman Yellen. He's also known as Nathan Yellen Moore, which means he talked with you very loudly. He was yelling more and more. Bad joke. Okay, bad joke. That's him in his later years as well. But I can show you younger pictures of these two men. And this Palestine Police Wanted poster. Okay, notice the guy with the black circle around him? Menachem Begin. That's Menachem Begin. This is the British police, one of these guys. Now, we're going to concentrate on this little trio down here. So let's go in for a close-up. Here is Nathan Friedman Yellen. He's one of the leaders of the Lehi. And guess who's next to him? Next to him is Yitzhak Shamir, who's going to eventually become one of the prime ministers of Israel. They all had a very checkered beginning of their careers, didn't they? All right. So there's a young picture of the younger guy. All right, extorting funds from Jewish shopkeepers, you know, these guys were terrorists, the Lehi soon engaged in indiscriminate shootings of the British police. Not infrequently, Lehi's members were themselves shot down in gun battles. The attacks mounted in intensity. So did British retaliation, mass arrests, curfews, the imposition of the death penalty on anyone carrying weapons. Still, the underground campaign went on, and once it included an unsuccessful murder attempt against the High Commissioner, Sir Harold McMichael, August 8, 1944. 3 months later, Lehi perpetuated its most audacious crime. It took place in Cairo, not in Palestine, but in Egypt. It was directed against Lord Moyne, the British minister resident. On November 6, 1944, two Stern gang members shot Moyne fatally as he was leaving the British residence. And here's a picture of the Egyptian minister, Lord Moyne. Probably didn't suspect anything because he was in Egypt rather than Palestine. Probably had no idea what was coming. Now, he was the guy that was assassinated, and this is a picture of his funeral in Egypt. Funeral of Lloyd Moyne and the Lance Corporal, H. Fuller, who was apparently killed along with him. The two youths were placed on trial in Cairo, January 10, 1945, were swiftly convicted and hanged. With few exceptions, the Zionist community was horror-stricken by Moyne's assassination. Page 130. Ben-Gurion issued a passionate appeal to the Yishuv. Cast out all members of this underground gang. Deny them shelter and assistance. And thereupon, the Haganah launched a full-scale attack against the Etzel and the Lehi members alike, denouncing them to the British police. But the damage to the Zionist cause was far-reaching. Jewish goodwill had come to an end. British patience was similarly exhausted. Jewish brigade formed and fights in Italy. Upon the invasion of Italy in the autumn of 1943, the front line shifted north from the Arab countries. It was then much simpler to justify Zionist participation in the struggle for Europe, where millions of Jews were being exterminated by the enemy. July 12, 1944, Churchill sent a memorandum to the war secretary, instructing him to begin organizing a Jewish army group. In October, the War Office appointed Brigadier Ernest Benjamin as commanding officer of the brigade. A Zionist banner was approved, together with a blue and white shoulder flash inscribed with the Shield of David. And here is that shoulder flash. I was able to find a picture of it. Notice, it's the yellow star, this time worn with pride, not in humiliation. The yellow star. A recruiting and training program was launched. Early in 1945, 3,400 Palestinian members of the brigade were shipped off for combat duty in Italy, where they were attached to the British 8th Army. Now, as it turned out, this Jewish fighting force represented the important political accomplishment of Zionist diplomacy during the war. Equipped with its own staff services and artillery support, it became the training ground where hundreds of Jewish officers and NCOs first mastered logistics, organization, and tactics on a brigade scale. The experience added to the Haganah reservoir of trained fighting men in the event of a post-war struggle against the British or the Arabs. So again, slowly but surely, God is putting together the Israel Defense Forces. He's training the Zionists to be able to fight a major war. He's getting ready. All right, 1945, World War II ends. Now, before we go on, I want to explain the significance of the Holocaust. Basically, the significance of the Holocaust is a satanic attack on the Abrahamic covenant. Remember the Abrahamic covenant? A covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the 12 tribes, consisting of three promises: the land promise, the nation promise, and the spiritual blessing promise. It is the nation promise that is coming under attack through the Holocaust. You know, believe me, Hitler's final aim was not 6 million Jews, but all 18 million, every one of us. That's what he would have liked to do. And that is a satanic attack against the nation promise, because Abraham was promised seed. He was promised a nation. If there are no Jewish people around, we can't call on the Messiah to return. There'd be no second coming, because we need to call upon the Messiah to return. Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, we have to call out. We have to beg him to return. If there's no Jewish people around, the Messiah will not return. Satan's career is safe. If there's no Jewish people around, the nation promise cannot be fulfilled. God is shown to be weak. He's not a promise-keeping God. And so he's not worthy of being God, and Satan's career is safe. You see this? You see why this is going on? So that is the theological importance of the Holocaust and all anti-Semitism today.
Okay?
How come we're not going to what? We are going to go a little more into the Holocaust right now. Be patient there, okay?
This is World War
II. Right. I'm giving you a little bit of a rabbit trail here off onto the Holocaust. And that was my exact next comment, Cynthia. You precede me by seconds. All right. Now I'm going to show you four famous pictures from the Holocaust right now. I'm not intending to shock anyone. These are by far not the worst pictures. These are pretty tame pictures. You see, when you're Jewish, you grow up with this stuff. You know, I grew up with this stuff. I grew up with books, with a lot worse pictures than you're going to see. So, please, I'm not trying to shock anybody. But, you know, we in the Jewish community, we know our history. So you can't get away from this. You can't get away from this. So here's a few pictures out of the Holocaust. You've seen a close-up of this one. This happened near Kiev. This is in the Ukraine. Here's the Jewish men, women, and children being shot down by the Einsatzgruppen, the German killing squads. Can you imagine yourself shooting down a woman and a child like that?
No.
It's just astounding to me. 1942. Same area that we hear about today in the news. Here's that very, very famous picture of the Warsaw Ghetto. Jews being taken out of the Warsaw Ghetto. You couldn't have composed this any better if you tried. All your attention goes to that little boy, doesn't it? All your eye, immediately, no matter what, forced to that little boy and the terror in his face. Here are some of the survivors of the Holocaust. Walking skeletons. These men are a hair's breadth away from death. Walking skeletons. But these are the ones that lived. And one more very, very famous picture. This picture is famous because right there is Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel. He is very famous for his book, Night. He chronicled his experience in the camps.
He was just at Chapman.
Yeah, he's still very active today. So this is the book he wrote, Night. It's available on Amazon.com. If you're interested in it, you can pick it up. And we have copies of it in the library. Let's see. Oh, yes, I have here, in fact, our librarian, Bonnie, started a waiting list for Night. So if you sign up on it, you'll be number 3 on the waiting list. 3 people in the morning class wanted to get it and read it. And by the way, off to my left here, you see the red cart. The middle shelf deals with books dealing with our class. You know, all books that relate to our class. So I'll put this down right here. If you're interested in getting on the waiting list for Night, that's available for you, and you'll be able to get it when it finally gets in the library.
But Bob, all this never happened, right?
Yeah, all this never happened, right, exactly. Now, question.
There's a book about that boy. It's called The Boy.
There's a book called The Boy about him? Yeah, and what?
Survived.
He did survive, yes, I know that.
And that picture was taken after the uprising.
Ah, yes.
They were digging him out.
They were cleaning out the ghetto, yeah. Okay, I heard that. He had survived.
It's
called The Boy, then. Do you know...
Who wrote it? No.
Okay, I'll look on Amazon and see if I can find it. And whatever. Okay. So, The Boy. Fascinating. Now, yes. Pictures were taken by Germans, sure. Yeah, they documented all this stuff. Now, another resource that I would recommend to you, not because it's fun to watch. How many have you seen Schindler's List? A good number of you. Those of you that haven't, it is not a fun movie to watch. But I recommend it because it gives an accurate picture of what really happened. Spielberg does it up properly. You watch Schindler's List and you know what Jewish people went through. And the reason I recommend all this stuff is because Americans today are getting more and more ignorant of the Holocaust. You remember Living Waters, DVD 180, you know? This deals basically with abortion. But what's the interview? What's the guy's name?
Ray Comfort.
Yeah, Ray Comfort interviews 20-somethings up north. What beach does he normally go? Huntington Beach, is that where you normally is? Okay. Up at Huntington Beach, he's interviewing 20-somethings. And what's the first question he asks them? Who's Adolf Hitler? They don't know. They have no idea. What's the Holocaust? They don't know. They have no idea. And when asked, if you were on a bulldozer and a guy was standing behind you with a gun and he said, either you bulldoze those Jewish people in front of you or I'll shoot you, what would you do? Most of them said, I'd bulldoze the people in front of me. Why? Because it's either them or me, so I might as well murder them. You know. Anyway, yes, you.
It's called The Boy.
The Boy.
Story by Dan Porat.
All right, the Boy by Dan Porat.
$2
on Amazon, a version. Okay, so if you want to read about that young boy.
No, I don't know if it's an e-book. Used.
Oh, used. Okay. Well, yeah, there's The Hiding Place as well, but that deals with a Christian woman's experience. Our class deals with Jewish experience in the Holocaust.
Yeah, but they went to the concentration camp.
Well, that she went to. Well, she didn't go to Auschwitz and Treblinka and Majdanek and all that. We're going to stick with Jewish experience here in this class, okay? Okay, we're going to stick with the Holocaust proper. Now, yes, The Hiding Place is a great movie, but that's just a little bit. Step away from our class. So anyway, I just show you this thing because Christians today are getting more and more ignorant of the Holocaust, more and more ignorant of what happened, and it's very sad. And if you want to understand the Jewish community, you have to understand the Holocaust, okay? We grew up with this thing. Question?
I just wanted to say that anybody can watch the video for free. It's on YouTube.
Anyone can watch 180 on YouTube. Yeah. Yeah, and you'll be shocked when you hear what these 20-somethings have to say about the Holocaust. They don't know nothing. So I would really encourage you to educate yourself on the Holocaust. Okay? So remember, we've got books in the heart of our library, and these are other resources you can use. And I'll see if I can put some more up maybe for next week. All right, next week we're going to start with a little introduction to the Holocaust. We're not going to spend a lot of time there because that's not the purpose of our class. But I do want to introduce you to the Holocaust. So we're just going to look at program number 4 from Against All Odds, The Miracle of Survival, Hitler and the Holocaust. Again, it's not going to be extensive, so don't worry. You're not going to get all the gruesome details, but you are going to get an overview, and that's all we're going to do for this class. Believe me, we're just going to touch the tip of the iceberg here. All right, so that'll begin our class next week with a 30-minute DVD. All right, amazing. I've got 5 minutes, 5 minutes before the class hour's over, so I guess I'll let you go 5 minutes early. You know, make up for all those times I kept you late. All right, so let me go ahead and pray, and I'll turn you loose, and we'll come back next week. Father, again, I think we should stand amazed as we see your preparation for the future, as you put the modern nation of Israel, the modern state of Israel together. You were putting together even an army because you knew what would happen when the state of Israel was declared. And so we know, we can see from this that you cover all eventualities, that you are not caught by surprise by anything, and that you work in conjunction with human beings, whether they trust in you or not, to bring about your will in the world. You know, things are done either God's way or period. That's it. Everything eventually, well, I guess I should say this. The world operates your way or eventually your way, one way or the other. But you are in charge. And help us to remember through this class as you see, as we see you putting together the details of the nation of Israel, that you put together the details for our life too. Nothing is wasted. Whatever we go through will prepare us for the future and to get through the trials of what's ahead of us. So help us always to embrace what we are faced with today, knowing that you are working out for the good of our lives tomorrow. So we lift ourselves up to you, hopefully gaining trust in you, in Yeshua's name. Amen. So we'll see you next week.